The Numinous Podcast with Carmen Spaniola.
Hi there, and welcome to The Numinous Podcast, where we have interesting conversations with everyday folks about the mystery of life. I'm your host, Carmen Spaniola, joining you from the lands of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples, the Songhees and the Esquimalt First Nations, recently known as Victoria, BC, Canada. Welcome, my friends, to the 2024 season of The Numinous Podcast. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the show. It began on March 31st, 2014. I will publish an episode this Sunday, March 31st, to honor this auspicious occasion. If you'd like to leave well wishes or birthday blessings for the show, go to castfeedback.com/numinouspodcast. So it's cast, like podcast, but just castfeedback.com/numinouspodcast. I'll link to that in the show notes as well. Just leave me a voice note or write a message. Let me know if there's been an episode that really meant something to you. I would love to hear that. But rather than launch the year, this season of the show with a vanity project, I really wanted to begin with a topic near and dear to my heart, and that, my friends, is adopting a spiritual approach to the pandemic. I'm thinking of it as a spiritual approach. What do I mean by that? Well, in the early days of the pandemic, for a minute there, we saw the beginnings of a public health response that was tangible, substantial. It was material. It was collective. It just like really had this physicality to it. And then we saw an emotional response that was initially marked by a strengthening movement towards grief and death literacy. For many, there was a return to simpler and more communal living that included self-provender, but also sharing of skills and resources, mutual aid, neighborliness. And then it was like capitalism kind of got us on the mental level, you know? Capitalism threatened by historic drops in output across almost all major economies went to work to ensure that our social response would be all but extinguished. So now we're 5 years into a global pandemic. You walk into most grocery stores and you see people in bars and restaurants, getting on airplanes, kids in school. Like, if you just took masking as a social signal, you would hardly know there was a deadly and disabling airborne disease to contend with. It's bonkers. So this episode is especially important for all those folks who want to be upstanding in their communities, you know, and who want to learn and grow and want to work for collective liberation, but don't always feel strong enough to stand out and wear the mask or ask for others to do so. And I totally get it. I have frozen when my pharmacist wasn't wearing a mask when I went to get my booster. And the first time that happened, like, I froze. I was so shocked that I just didn't say anything. I just got in and out of that little room. And then I had to like come up with a script for myself to say, hey, would you mind wearing a mask, please? Hey, would you mind wearing a mask, please? Hey, would you mind wearing a mask, please? I had just been so shocked that the healthcare provider giving me my booster wasn't wearing a mask. I didn't have time to think. So I totally get you for freezing or, you know, not doing anything or kind of wondering like, oh, should I make a fuss? You know, this episode is also for folks who have heard about long COVID, but they don't have firsthand experience with it or don't think they do, or are feeling like perhaps it's a rare disease or it's mainly affecting like already immune compromised people or mainly older people. Like, I want to sidebar with you for a moment because it's not. So I recently taught a class on long COVID for members of the Numinous Network. And most of the research I cited came from the Statistics Canada report that came out in December 2023. So for folks outside Canada, Stats Can is our national statistical office. It's a federal agency, and they compile statistics on population, resources, economy, society, culture, that sort of thing. And so what they said is like 16% of the Canadian population that got COVID. So of all the people who got COVID, 16% still had symptoms 6 months later. And so this was of statistics of all the data that they had by 2022. So of that amount, that 16% who got long COVID, 50% of them never got better. So there was like 12 million people who had gotten COVID by 2022. 16% of them got long COVID, and of that 16%, half never got better. But like, here's the line that caught my eye, okay? And like, for folks who are like, whoa, that's overwhelming, feel your seat, feel your feet. It's okay. We've got ideas here that will help you feel, again, that spiritual connection, which is, you know, I think of the spiritual approach to the pandemic is that we reach towards what we care about. We reach towards connection. We reach towards each other. We open to the other, to something greater than us, and we hold to that vision together. So we can do this, but just stick with me for a moment here, because this line really stood out to me. So Stats Can said, among individuals who reported not experiencing symptoms 3 months or longer after a COVID-19 infection in the summer of 2022. Okay, so this is just who we're talking about. There was an Omicron spike in the summer of 2022. People who got COVID then but did not have symptoms 3 months later, when they went back now by December 2023, they have 11% of those people have since reported developing long-term symptoms after that same infection that couldn't be explained by anything else. So they got COVID during the spike in the summer of 2022. Things were fine for the first few months, but since then, without even getting COVID again, 11% of them developed long COVID. So there's still lots that we're still learning about this nefarious disease, my friends. Very nefarious. And one of the things that I just want folks to be aware of is that since that first like big Omicron wave in December 2021, there's been an increase in what we call mild symptoms. So like cough, nasal congestion, and sore throat. In other words, more and more COVID initially looks like a cold. But what the science is telling us is that there's this relationship between infectious diseases like COVID and non-communicable diseases like cancer and heart disease. So in other words, if you're immunocompromised from a pre-existing disease, you're more likely to get COVID. And if you get COVID, you're more likely to develop a new non-communicable disease. So like, think about how like many very, very serious diseases don't seem so bad at first. You just feel a little run down. So COVID's kind of like that now. You feel run down. It seems like a cold. Our tests are not actually for the strains of COVID we now have. So your testing is showing that you don't have COVID, but you actually do. So think about other diseases that are very serious that, you know, don't seem so bad at first, like heart disease, like HIV, like cancer. These aren't like instant ailments, right? So COVID is similar, and it's no joke. And in order to get good at risk assessment, you've got to not only know the facts, but you have to feel empowered. You have to feel strong enough to act on them, even in the face of a society that's telling you, both directly and indirectly, that you're overreacting, you're being a downer, the pandemic's over, right? You've got to be strong enough. You've got to feel like people are with you and validating you, that you are tracking the threat accurately. So this episode is lovingly dedicated. It goes out to all those of us who are still COVIDing, those of us living with or supporting those with long COVID. It's for those folks with sensitive immune systems who are furious and heartbroken. Like, I see you. I am with you. I am still with you. And I care about you. And my guest, Dana Knuckles, the People's Oracle, she cares about you. She cares about you. You know she does, because she is out here every damn day for years now, gathering the people, giving us the facts, telling us the truth, alerting us to what's coming, reminding us how things could be, showing us a different way. In the words of the great activist Tony Cade Bambara, making the revolution irresistible. That's what Dana Knuckles is doing. Dana is the creator of the Divination for Liberation framework of sidereal astrology, and is also the creator of the Seven Essential Needs framework. Dana is a musician, a writer, a speaker, a teacher, and a multi-oracular diviner. And I'm thrilled to welcome Dana to the podcast to tell us about sidereal astrology and fill us in on our newest project called the People's Public Health Education Campaign. So make a cup of tea, pull up a chair, grab a pen and make some notes, because Dana's about to tell you about your life and things you need to know to get through it these next few years. So Dana, what identities do you lead with?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I don't think of myself as identities. Isn't that weird? I don't think of myself. I mean, I have roles that I play. And I'm definitely someone who is very much focused on fulfilling and playing the roles that I play with integrity and intentionality. So I play the role of mother to my child. I play the role of astrologer to the community of people who look to my guidance. To myself, I'm just Dana. Some people look at me and see woman. They look at me and see Black. And I definitely identify with those, you know. But yeah, those, that's how I move through the space of identity.
I know you as the People's Oracle. Such moving, profound, epic work in the world. The astrology that you provide to folks is different from so much else I see in the world. Can you explain the difference between tropical and sidereal astrology?
Yeah, so real quick, let's talk about what astrology is at first, right? I don't ever enter discussions about astrology assuming that there is a consensus on what it is, and also what it is from my perspective as a professional versus a layperson. So I understand astrology to be a language. It is a timekeeping and time-making mechanism that has the added component of meaning. So it clocks time like a calendar or a clock, but the symbols, the language of astrology, also provides an interpretive framework or reference point, right? So the primary component of astrology is first the planets and then a zodiac. So you can think of a zodiac as like a way to segment time, right? In most zodiacs, time is standardized, just like we have a clock that is standardized, right? 12 noon, 12 midnight, right? That's when the day switches over. There is a standardization of time that we count with the zodiac. So the zodiac in almost all systems is not aligned with actual physical bodies, meaning that the zodiac is not like, oh, there are constellations, that's a zodiac. No, the zodiac is a projection onto the sky, and we standardize it by taking that circle, that great circle, and splitting it up into 30 degree sections, right? Mm-hmm. Each of those 30 degree sections we call a sign, or a sidereal zodiac sign, or a zodiac sign. The fundamental question of tropical versus sidereal is first the technical aspect, the astronomical aspect of where do you begin counting time, right? The tropical zodiac begins counting time at the vernal or spring equinox in the northern hemisphere. And that's the way that the tropical zodiac has standardized time. The sidereal zodiac, there are actual many different sidereal calculations called ionomasias. And these are using a different reference point to start the beginning of the zodiac, right? So the system I use, all of the sidereal calculations use a fixed star and say this is the reference point for how we're going to calculate the beginning of the zodiac. Now, I also talked about the interpretive framework or interpretive reference point. This is also a point of diversion between tropical astrology and sidereal astrology. There are tropical astrologies and there are sidereal astrologies. And it just depends on where you are in history and where you are on the planet at any given time that will determine the type of astrology that you are exposed to or have access to in your culture. For me, I understand there to be a tropical framework that is rooted in the historical lineage of how the tropical zodiac became the dominant calculation. And sidereal was a little bit more complicated. Most people might be familiar with Vedic astrology or Indian astrology or Jyotish. That is that is a sidereal astrology, but it is unique to the Indian culture, what is called Hinduism, and loosely associated with the Vedas, which is the scriptural text of Hinduism. So what I practice is divination for liberation, sidereal astrology, and it is a framework that is meant to be in alignment with where we are now in history and to give that language and timekeeping in a way that is accessible and culturally relevant to where we are in history and where we are in place.
Why were you drawn to the sidereal tradition, if that's the right terminology, versus tropical?
That is a really interesting question. I've had an interest in astrology my entire life. When I was a little girl, and you'd go to like the candy store or Walgreens or the grocery store, they'd have these little scrolls.
Star scrolls.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, my friend Christine Jakubowski and I used to get them every month. Oh my gosh.
Never got
Forgot
a.
about those.
Oh my God, that is seared in my memory because I could never have one. I grew up in a Pentecostal black church. And so that was in the pile of, don't do that. That's sinful. It's an abomination. But I was just so curious and I would just hope that there would be left one that someone had opened so that I can read the horoscope. But eventually, as I got older, it grew into a real deep interest for me. Some would call it a special interest. And being that special interest of mine, I'm a pattern seeker and a pattern maker, and things need to make sense to me. I was that annoying kid in sixth grade that got the award for telling teachers how to do their job. Listen, man, everybody could use some feedback. Why not from the student, right? But that's really a testament to like the way my mind works. Like I need it to make sense. I need the dots to connect. I'm not just gonna connect the dots because it says 1, 2, 3 if there's a different picture emerging. And so as I got deeper and more serious into my studies, I was like, this is something's wrong. Like something, I went in with the assumption that the authors and astrologers that I was reading, like they weren't just making things up. It had to make sense, particularly as I delved into some of the older texts from the Hellenistic era and from the Renaissance era, right? Like I was like, okay, I know these people are stupid. This has to make sense. And so, long story short, the seed of the sidereal zodiac had been planted in my mind over several years. And I was like, well, let me try this. And as soon as I looked at a handful of charts using the sidereal calculation, it was like somebody flipped on a light, and I was like, see, I knew it. I knew I wasn't crazy. And that was in 2014. That was 7 years into my practice and study. And I spent 2 years like trying to reverse engineer and make sense of how this calculation fit with what I already knew. And it was in 2016 where I started the People's Oracle because I felt like, okay, I'm seeing something, I'm getting it. And Divination for Liberation sidereal astrology has emerged and grown over the past, what, 7 years now, from that point.
Wow. So are there cultural or ancestral considerations that someone should take into account in terms of whether to follow one tradition or the other?
I think that that is such a sticky question. It's such a sticky question because I think that I have my own convictions and beliefs about how we should maneuver spiritual spaces and traditions. And I know that a lot of people love their tropical astrology. There are people who are not Indian or they don't practice Hinduism and they love Vedic astrology. I would then say that it is less of a cultural or ancestral consideration that a person might consider. I would say that it would be a political, it is a political consideration in terms of what type of astrology or what type of or what style of astrology a person should use. I think the question that anyone should ask themselves is this naming me and my experience? Is it giving reverence to my suffering? Is it acknowledging my struggle? When you get into astrology and other forms of divination and the woo, as I like to call it, you can really get caught up in a lot of spiritual bypassing, meaning using spiritual ideologies to override one's subjective emotional experience to downplay one's suffering. And I think that there's a huge danger of that with astrology, that it becomes another tool that people use to, avoid recognizing the truth of their own experience. And so that's why the political is really, really, really important to me in terms of, the reference point one uses to determine which type of astrology they should follow.
Good advice. Okay, well, let's get into it. What does sidereal astrology have to tell us about the politics of 2024? Like, how's it looking, Dana?
Oh, Carmen. I just want to tell everyone that I'm a realist. I love humans. And so people can look around and see that shit's not right. What the astrology has to say is I actually want to read an excerpt from my 2024 sidereal astrology guide. I've gotten into the habit of using the summary for the astrology of December to be a retrospective on the year. And so if you get the guide and you read December, it's actually a summation and interpretation of the year as a whole.
Okay.
And the theme for 2024, Divination for Liberation style, is don't let them make you forget. And I started off this piece, Don't Let Them Make You Forget, which you can actually find it on my blog, talking about all of the miraculous things that happened in 2020, how we saw the pollution clear, how people were getting moratoriums on evictions, how people got health insurance, they got a little extra cash, and millions of children were lifted out of poverty. Every single thing that our government have told us is impossible, that cannot happen, that there is no public will for, that there is no political will for, that is a problem that's too big to be surmounted. We surmounted it. I saw the skies clear. I saw people safe. I saw people having enough to eat. I saw people with health care. And so the theme of 2024 is don't let them make you forget, because one of the things we're experiencing this year already, and it will amp up, is they're going to try to make you look feel like 2020 never happened. They're going to try to make you feel like all of those things that you experienced were not real, particularly around the George Floyd rebellion. We are reaching at a critical inflection point around what that was. And we need to be interpreting everything that has happened as the institutional powers that be, their intention is to make sure that 2020 never happens again, not COVID, but to make sure that health care, that unemployment checks, the stimulus checks, the eviction moratoriums, the clear skies, they end the George Floyd rebellion where the whole world chanted Black Lives Matter at once. Every single thing that they have done since then, including their approach to COVID, is to make sure that that never happens again, and don't let them make you forget. The last piece I'll say about 2024 is belonging is the theme. We all have this sense, this need to feel ourselves as the same as others. We all have this need to be around other people where we feel like we can successfully participate in the group bonding and communal behaviors. And so this is what I want to read, and this will be the last thing that I'll say. Revolution is the act of imposing your internal distress on the environment so that it has a vested interest in your peace. Revolution is sharing the weight and burden of discomfort with others rather than swallowing it down until it forms a cancerous tumor of shame and alienation in your gut. When did you lose your capacity to cry for help to a lie that says you can take care of yourself by yourself? When did you lose your humanity to self-disregard in adaptation to your caregivers and society's disregard of you? When did you lose your longing for comfort to a neglect that has normalized suffering you don't deserve? When did you become so afraid of feeling? Your feelings are the instrument of change you can wield with power and force. You've done it before. Revolution begins in the body. Freedom begins in the imagination. Liberation is what happens when we revolt and imagine together. Don't let them make you forget.
Freedom begins in the imagination. So, would you say that sidereal astrology, when you're looking at it, are you looking through the lens of what could be possible? Like when you're actually reading transits in the chart, is that kind of part of the approach? Is that the liberatory aspect of it? Like what could be possible given these prevailing influences?
Yeah, I mean, real talk, Carmen, I think of what I do is as in part, yes, you know, this is the possibility of these transits. But I also look at it as I have like secret access to the playbook of capitalists and the whole institution. I know what they're going to do. And if we could use that information to our advantage, that's where the divination for liberation comes in. I said in 2022, I said, look, man, 2023 is our year to get organized because the policing is coming down hard in 2024. The you know, all of the self-exploration that people did in 2020 and 2021 and in part 2022 around their identities. All of that over. They're shutting it down. It's not going to be safe to be trans. It's not going to be safe to be black. Whatever, all you see it already with the diversity, equity, and inclusion, all of those departments getting outlawed and shut down, right? And so to know and see that this is coming, how do we respond to that, right? And part of my work as someone who works with individuals is this is the way that these systems, this is the way that these larger trends of policing and belonging and self-determination. This is the way it distills down to you personally. And as you're personally working through these things in your own life, this is where the liberation begins. That's where it begins. Yeah.
That sense of having the playbook and being able to anticipate, just knowing what's going to come, there is a loneliness in being the savant. I think back to, when my kiddo came out to us as trans, well, I guess that was 2015 or 16. And my fear, and it was very difficult for me to articulate because there was such a blossoming, there was such like a flourishing that came sort of shortly after that with, young people especially being more out and more creative in their gender expression. And my fear kept being, I just, can we just slow down around the medical pieces? Because I just worry that our social safety net here, I'm in Canada, is contracting. It's going to keep contracting. Like, can we really think long term about sort of tying your biology to a medical system? Let's just like slow the roll a little bit. And that was so difficult for, I don't know, trying to find good care for my child, trying to find advocacy, trying to be nuanced, trying not to be turfy, but at the same time be collapsy. Like, I was just like, this is difficult. But I just felt like, no, my fear is that it's not safe to be trans, even though everything around me at that time seemed almost like a renaissance of flourishing for years. And now, of course, the last couple of years, I'm like, oh, thank God we don't live in America. That's how I feel all the time. Thank God we don't live, or, I'm sure there are Americans who think, thank goodness I don't live in these particular states, right? So it's kind of a lonely place to be. I'm curious if this lens on the world, has it impacted your parenting in that kind of way where, your kid is like, but the world is doing this. And you're like, I know, but we're going to walk this path a little. Like, how do you navigate that as a parent?
Quite frankly, I follow the lead of my child. He has never been a follower. He's never been comfortable. The status quo has always been dangerous to him. And so, I'll never forget that. He decided he wasn't going to school. How old is he? 7 years old? Was it 7? 20, 20. Yeah, he was 7 years old. His body was just like, I'm not okay. And he put his foot down. And it was really difficult for me because I was living with my parents at the time and they were like, absolutely no homeschooling. And I remember the day I just had to relinquish control. And I think that, yes, it's really this dance of, navigating the way that your child is as their authentic self versus the way that the world is. But the world will not change as long as people keep conforming to the way that we don't want it to be. Right? Like I call it, there are some people who carry the burden of being a change maker merely by existing, right? Their bodies are the site of the terror that says, are you going to swallow yourself? And like I said, that cancerous tumor in your gut of shame and alienation, or are you going to live out as the embodiment of a threat to the system? It's a lose-lose situation. It really, really is. So I think for me, being a person who's red as black, I've got brown skin, my kid is red as black, right? There's a fierceness of protection and a conviction that we're going down fighting. Right? Because either I'm gonna die because I'm masking, because, I'm hiding and I'm trying to get my child to fit into these spaces that are not carved out for the shape of his heart, right? And he's gonna get hurt, or we're gonna live free and die trying.
Let's talk about the healthcare aspect of it then, because you and I are both, I guess that what they call us is like COVID hawks. I just
Oh,
call us
I've never
COVID
heard of that.
cautious. Yeah, COVID hawks. And I'm like, well, hawks are great. They have such great perspective. They're so,
Listen, they can hear and see everything.
Yeah, exactly. So we're COVID cautious people, or some people say still COVIDing. I'm curious what the astrology tells us about our collective care and liberatory movements around collective care and health. Like, what's going to happen with are we going to get it together?
Oh man, this is where the don't let them make you forget comes in. There's an image floating around of a concert in Seattle where the performers and the entire audience is masked. And this has been such an incredible, hopeful image for those of us who are still COVIDing.
Is it a recent image? Oh,
I've
amazing.
actually had one of my followers. After I reposted the pic, one of my followers said, "I am a part of the mask block that provided masks for this event." And so this is, th but yeah, this is where the don't let them make you forget comes in, right? I want to take this moment to name something that people may not necessarily have the language for. I think they have the felt sense of it, but they don't have the language for it. There are two primary battles happening at large. One is a battle for emotional control, and the other is deeply connected to that, which is a battle, an information war, right? Both of these wars, both of these battles are fighting for the terrain of our body, right? And part of this process is around withholding information in a way that makes us skeptical of our own pain and suffering, right? It makes us struggle to connect the dots and make sense of what we're experiencing on a physiological level because the information that would make that go, aha, is being withheld. They're not counting, they're not testing. They have not updated the test. They are, shutting down parts of the CDC website that have been devoted to COVID. This removal of information is so that when you go out and look for validation around what you're experiencing with your health, there's nothing there. And then you're left to feel like you're crazy, right? The
Yes.
emotional battle part, I think, is so deep and so important. And this is about, who is and what is the threat? When we look at racism, capitalism, the domination of whiteness as like a cultural identity, this is all about emotional manipulation that says, hey, your body and your personal experience does not tell you what is safe or dangerous. Your race tells you what is safe or dangerous. Your class tells you what is safe or dangerous. I tell you, Donald Trump, I, Biden, I, Kamala Harris, I, Democratic Party, I, Republican Party, I, Sinclair News Network, I tell you who is safe and who is dangerous. I tell you what the real threats are. Right? When you look at even like the right wing machine, the whole function of it is to get people to override their personal subjective experience and subscribe to a narrative about where the real source of danger is coming from. So the source of danger is not coming from COVID. The source of danger is not coming from measles. It's not coming from capitalism. It's not coming from the police. It's coming from immigrants. It's coming from Black people. It's wokeness. It's diversity,
Wokeness.
right? It's this. It's and this is not just stupidity. This is, and I know a lot of left-leaning people, myself included, often land in, well, this is just stupid. How are they being taken advantage of this way? And it's not stupid. It's psychological warfare. It is emotional manipulation. And unfortunately, many people on the left have been subject to it as well in terms of their relationship with COVID and what they think or believe is going on, right? So all of this to say, this is the container that we're in. And I think that this theme of belonging becomes really, really, really important, right? Because belonging means I need to look around and feel like I can successfully participate in society. I feel like that need for sameness, right? So many of my clients that I've worked with have, we've been looking back to, 2012, and for some people, 2001, right? As a reference point for what we're personally experiencing under this sky right now. And for so many of them, myself included, it was like the first time that I looked around and was like, oh, I belong here. Or getting this sense of like, oh, I don't belong here, but I know why now, right? And so, how are we creating spaces where we belong? This is actually part of why I am starting the People's Public Health Education Campaign. But before we talk about that, I just want to say COVID's not going to be over this year. We're going to see a big wave come August. That August, September, October, November, and then December again, we might beat the peak we just did,
Oh,
right?
wow. But the peak we just did was like the biggest since 2022 or
Yeah.
something like that. Oh,
Yeah.
okay. So you
Yeah.
think we could even extend? Yeah. I mean, I'm shocked, not shocked. Like
Right.
that's just the math mathing. That's just how it goes if you don't do anything about this, right? But
Yeah.
you know,
Yeah.
I okay.
Yeah.
August, hey. Okay, so I've been looking even in tropical astrology. I'm like, so August, friends. Looks crunchy
Yeah.
and like keeps looking like that for the second half of the year. So kind of doesn't matter which tradition, we've all got the same conditions we're working with,
Yeah,
and we're all interpreting difficulty.
I actually used Bazi, Chinese astrology, to make my predictions on COVID waves, and it's like math. It's like 1 + 1 = 2. And so yes, yeah, so August and December are like major peaks for me. I do see April as, I don't know if we're gonna get like well, we've already got a new treatment, right? The new monoclonal, I don't know how you say it, antibody treatment for people who do not produce a strong enough immune response from the vaccination. There actually is a new one that has been it's got that emergency use authorization.
Okay.
I'm still, on hold to see if we're gonna make any progress in the mitigation direction for April. But regardless, whatever happens, sorry.
This is just kind of what it is. Do you,
Yeah.
so that was kind of my follow-up was going to be, do you know, you as just a as a person, as a, you know, as a mammal trying to figure out how you're gonna, you know, how, raise a child, educate a
Yeah.
child, help them, you know, move out into the world. You must cast your awareness forwards at times and look at where the possibilities for, yeah, mitigation or treatment or prevention is. Are there periods where we go into like a medical flourishing or some kind of renaissance where it's like we could hope for some kind of treatment? I'm thinking about the you know, the millions of sufferers of this mass disabling event.
I do think that this year overall, that there will be treatments. We've already got one, right? I'm hoping that this public health education campaign that I'm doing moves the needle. And so this is happening alongside parallel to the fact that there is no unified consensual mitigation effort or public health education campaign being enforced by the government, right? And so we're kind of left with these gaps of healthcare access and knowledge that unfortunately means that most people won't have access to them. If we pull the lens out a little bit further back, I think that, 20, let's say 2027. I know, I'm sorry.
I mean, at least it's
But
in the 20s.
yeah, 2027 for me, I'm not going to call it a hard stop, that's at least in terms of Bazi, Chinese astrology, for me, 2027 is when I'm like, ooh, okay. Because I still see the sprinkles of stuff in 26, 20, 25 and 26, even though things definitely start to shift by 2026, I think 2027 is like, okay, all right, where it's the there's a light somewhere that we're seeing in terms of efforts to really get this thing reined in.
Okay, so you're not seeing like the mass spikes that you see predictively in the next year or two.
I think that we'll have mass spikes in 2024. I think that we will see them in 2025 and six, but here's the thing. When we talk about spikes, the thing that we're dealing with right now is that they're not receding, right? So with every single surge, the baseline of cases that is happening and the amount of COVID that is free floating through the air at any given time gets higher and higher. And so, unfortunately, it's like, yeah, the spikes may not be as extreme, but the baseline of cases keeps rising.
Right. It's just on an elevated, so it's like we have an elevated mass or an elevated plateau, and you have a spike from that. So, even if you come down, you're still coming down to an elevated plateau. It's like climbing stairs. It's like
Yes.
you take a step up and like, okay, we flattened, but we're higher than we used to be. So,
Yeah, like I just
yeah.
saw one of the folks on Twitter who does the case forecasting. And they talked about April 3rd being like the nadir, the low point of coming off this wave, but it's not lasting long. It's, gonna
Right,
go
going
right
back
back
up.
up.
I
So
see. Okay, so tell us more about the People's Public Health Education campaign. And I'm particularly interested in like what happened? What made you go like, okay, friends, I have to like clear the desk and I need to work on this project. So tell us what it is and how did it come to be?
yeah, so the People's Public Health Education Campaign is born out of two things for me. One, it is being a part of this informal network of people across the internet who have been exchanging information, who have been keeping up with the latest research, who's been tracking cases, right? It's very informal. We're like the ragtag army of COVID cautious people holding it down, right? But what I started to notice as we're in year five, and there has been a lot of energy directed towards hoping that the government will change course. They have not. There has been a lot of frustration and anger. We're people that need for sameness, right? People need to see that their community of fellow mask wearers are wearing masks all the time, right? Because it makes me feel safe. It makes you feel like I belong here, right? But I noticed that the tone and the motivation behind a lot of the educational content I saw was either condescending, or moralizing. And as someone who runs a business and who's also a performer, I know that you can be right and no one will listen to you. You can have all the facts, no one will listen to you, right? And for those of us who are immune compromised and managing chronic health issues or long COVID, we just don't have the bandwidth to think of those things sometimes. But I have the bandwidth to really consider messaging. I have the bandwidth to consider medium. And so I have the will to try to bring some folks together to see what kind of educational content we can create to not just educate the people who are already committed to avoiding infection and mitigating transmission, but people just don't know. We have to understand that we have this network that's closed, but if you're not on the internet, where are you getting your information from? Right? And so I think of it as a balance in a way, right? I, as one person, can have a conversation with a family member that says, hey, this is what COVID's doing. This is long COVID. This is what you need to be worried about. But if the majority of the information, if the information pool they're swimming in is not even mentioning COVID, it's like I just spit in the ocean, right? And so there's this way that we need to harness a sense of entitlement as a community that the government's not coming to save us. You know, I am taking so many cues from the early days of the AIDS and HIV epidemic and the types of organizations that they created and the way that they politically moved the needle. And so many of the public health things that we've had come from that era, right? So the other piece is, as I have been a layperson public health educator, meaning I've kind of unconsciously and just by circumstance taken on this role of becoming someone who others look to for accurate information about COVID. I'm their sanity maker, right? Like, you're not crazy. This is still happening, right? You know, I think, again, this really comes from the fact that, like, I'm an artist, I am a professional communicator and a business owner, and I can just see with my eyes, like, oh, okay, this is such a great effort to educate, but there's way too many words, right? Or who is it that you're tar have you are you intentional about this is such a beautiful piece of art or comic or drawing or graphic that someone has created? Who's your audience? Right? And so these are questions that I want to think about, and I want to pull some people together and say, look, man, we gotta teach the people what's going on. Back in the 80s and 90s, the United States government public health industrial complex was not educating people on AIDS. Gay men had to educate each other. They had to create these spaces where they were learning and keeping up with the latest research. They even, I mean, in the book How to Survive a Plague by David France, I think is his name, I had no idea that this happened, but it just really inspired me. Obviously, really terrible circumstances that this happened under. But there was a point where there was some kind of treatment. I think it was in Israel, actually. And those who had the means were flying to Israel to get this treatment because it was showing some promise. But the FDA refused to approve this treatment so that it can be manufactured in America. It was a company that had already figured it out and was just waiting for this approval so that people with AIDS or HIV could get this treatment that was showing some promise. The government refused to do it. This group of activists went to the facilities of the pharmaceutical company who was had the recipe for this thing and said, please give us the recipe. Please, please. And these people found a compound maker and were passing out versions of this treatment protocol from a church. I mean, this is how talk about grassroots. This is how we need to be moving, because we are trying to push the government in the direction and we need to run out ahead of them.
So, what are some of the grassroots things that you envision as part, like paint the picture? How would a person, maybe on the internet, but maybe not on the internet, encounter some of the work of the People's Public Health Education Campaign? Like, what do you envision this will be?
Oh man, so just FYI, we're having a meeting April 3rd, and I'll be going through all of this in the meeting in a more formal way.
And
But
everyone's invited to the meeting. When you say we, who's that?
so myself and James Poteet, he has come on to really help me execute these ideas and a lot of the administrative and social media tasks he's just been really on top of. So shout out to James. We're hosting the meeting, and really quickly, I just shared this, and so I want to share it here about who are we looking for, and this is actually on my Instagram, and it says this meeting is for you if you are conscientious about limiting transmission of SARS-2 and would love for other people to be too. You are curious about participating in a project that channels your energy and conviction into educating the public on SARS-2, and you have a knowledge and skills in the areas of Relevant Sciences, Communication, and Visual Arts.
Why are you
So,
calling it SARS-2 instead of COVID?
because, oh, great question.
Thank you.
So, SARS coronavirus 2 is the name of the virus, right? And this virus causes the disease COVID-19. There was an intentional effort. You can find the emails back and forth between folks at the CDC. So you there's evidence of this in CDC emails that I believe have been released through Freedom of Information Act that you can find, where there was an intentional and concerted effort to name this virus in the public vernacular as COVID-19 instead of SARS-2. So you remember back in like 2003 or whatever it was, there was SARS-1, SARS coronavirus 1, and it was really bad. They call this SARS coronavirus 2 because, excuse me, it's from the same virus family, severe acute respiratory syndrome 2, right? The disease, the infection is called COVID-19. And this is part of the education process, right? To understand what is this, right? What is this thing? There's a virus that causes an infection, causes COVID-19. Did I answer your
Thank you.
question?
Yes, thank you. Okay, so now paint the picture for us of what the education campaign will be like.
All right. So my vision here is that first, there is a growing body of groups all across the world called mass blocks, mask blocks, long COVID advocacy groups, clean air clubs. And these are people who have taken the reins of power in their communities to lead the charge in preventing transmission of SARS-2, in equipping their communities with the resources that they need to gather safely and to live safely, whether that is by distributing masks to people who cannot afford them, distributing masks at events, loaning out air purifiers at events so that these spaces can be accessible and safe for everyone. This is like, it's like low-hanging fruit on a tree. It's like, oh my God, there's already this network. What if I got together and built these teams, built a science and technology team who knows all about SARS-2, who does all the reading and compiling of information, right? This is the latest research. This is what we know. This is the science of it. And then we've got a communication team who is full of copywriters and marketers and advertisers and media communications experts, even some public health communication experts. And we're taking all of this information. And not only are we creating campaigns, which are fleshed out strategies for how we're communicating specific information, we're also going to be creating accessibility and visual messaging standards so that anybody who wants to educate their community, anybody who wants to create art or educational content and materials has some standards to refer to. There are so many artists who are creating beautiful stuff. I just happen to have the eye to be able to say, hey, this is so good. Can we make the text bigger? Can we use a different color scheme? People who, elderly people might struggle with this language. Who are you targeting with this? These are all the kinds of things that we'll be focusing on in the communications team. Then we have a team of artists and visual artists, storytellers, painters, illustrators, graphic designers, web designers, animators, right? These are people who are going to execute the artistic component of these campaigns that we create in alignment with the visual messaging and accessibility standards. That's the vision.
Amazing. So it'll be things like maybe you'll have posters that people could go onto a website and just download from anywhere in the world. They could have something to put at their event or on the telephone pole or that kind of thing,
Yeah,
that
at their
it's going to
church,
be
at the barber
accessible.
shop, at wherever. And I think I also would love if for every piece of printed material that's out there, there's a little QR code, and you can come to a social media website or a website, and you can learn all of the information. Where can I get these resources from? Where's my clean air club? Where's my mask block? Where's my long COVID advocacy group? Right? This network of mask blocks and clean air clubs, they're already on the ground. They're already building relationships in their community. They already know so much about what is in need in their community, and they're the perfect network to distribute this content. Right?
Absolutely. I can totally imagine, having something like that. Like, here's templates for sending out your wedding invitation. Here's templates for your Christmas party. Here's templates. Here's some languaging you can use for your next community association voting. Here's how you manage having a genuinely robust remote option for your meeting. Here's your, oh, you already have a little free tool library, a tool library, lending library in your community. We have PCR tests, or we have like the machines for your big public event or your concert. I mean, that just sounds amazing. So what are the two steps? First of all, how do people come to the meeting on April 3rd? And then if they can't come to the meeting, how do they stay tuned to what you're doing here?
I just want to say real quick that some of the stuff that you're talking about, these clean air clubs and mask blocks are already doing. And so I really encourage everyone who's listening, if you don't use Instagram, just hold your nose for a minute and go on there. There are, I mean, every week there's a new clean air club or mask block popping up in cities all over the world. And if you are someone who needs as access to masks and you can't afford it, find your local mask block. If you are hosting events that you want to be safe, find your local clean air club. They will bring the air purifiers and masks to your event. I mean, chef's kiss is so good. What the people's public health education is focused on is educating the public on what SARS-2 is and how they can protect themselves, what to know, what to look out for. Because I fully believe that there's a way to communicate and create a critical mass of information that can influence the behavior of the public. I totally believe that, and I'm gonna test out my theory. So, how can people participate? Wednesday, April 3rd at 6 p.m. Central Time via Zoom. I will be presenting a lot of the information that I shared here today. And there will be a question and answer portion. It is free to attend. I want to say where people can register. I'm sure you can put it in the description here, but there's
Absolutely.
bit.ly, right? PPHEC 2024, right? This is where you can go register, and you'll be signing up in an email form. And that's the way that we'll send out the Zoom link. If you
Perfect.
cannot attend, well, first of all, if you can attend and you are deaf or hard of hearing, we are securing an ASL interpreter. The slides and minutes from the meeting will be made available both to those who have attended and those who have not attended. So even if you cannot attend in person, please sign up. We will send you the link so that you can view the slides and the minutes from the meeting. We will be announcing our intake process for people who come to the meeting or review the meeting contents afterward and decide, hey, this is for me, I want to do it. We will be launching the intake process after the meeting and begin getting to work as soon as possible.
Amazing. So you're really focused on, I mean, if I were to just say it, like kind of call it straight, helping people believe that SARS-2, that COVID exists, that it is a risk for them, that there are serious risks, that they can't, without understanding that it is real and that like these are the qualities of it, they can't actually make good risk assessment. You can't actually make good decisions if you don't have all the information. So you're trying to just give people the information so that they can mitigate their risk and know how much risk they are undertaking when they, don't have mitigations in place. It's like fairly basic for those
Oh,
of us who've been,
absolutely.
hawks for a while. But it turns out, I mean, I don't know, what's the, how many people are there that still don't actually think it's a serious disease. There's quite a few people. So you're trying to make it not only accessible, but with the art and all of that, it sounds like you're trying to make it sexy, right? Isn't that, what's that quote? The role of the artist is to make the revolution irresistible.
I mean, no, you've totally got it. I think that, again, referring to some of the activism and public health education that occurred, during the early days of HIV/AIDS, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, right? They created this pamphlet on safe sex, right? That term, safe sex, came from gay men, right? Their promotion of condom usage changed the economic, right? Market around condoms. Their campaign was so successful that the condom manufacturers had to up their production, right? Just all of this comes from that time. And I think that we can do something different, right now. There are mask manufacturers and wholesalers that are struggling to stay in business because masks have gone out of vogue. And we got to switch this up. We got to switch this up. The last thing that I wanted to say too is that one of the things that's informing my approach to this campaign is the astrology of this moment. And understanding why people are not taking precautions. Yes, part of it is absolutely lack of education. But the nature of humans is not to dominate, it is to belong. And belonging manifests in mimicking the behavior of the people who are in closest proximity to you so that you can stand out, so that you can not be perceived as a threat. And so that you, yes, I'm one of them, or they see me as one of them. This is what assimilation is, right? People immigrate here and they, keep their children from speaking the language because you're going to stand out too much. And so I really believe that almost all of people's lack of mitigation is social. It's purely social. And so we've got to figure out how to unlock that mystery. How can we peer pressure some folks, not shame, not judge, not condescend, but how can we, like you say, make it sexy? How can we make it attractive? We can do it. We can do it. I mean, I just want to say, gay men changed their sexual behavior. I mean, anyone listening is interested, please read How to Survive a Plague. It'll really, really, really give you some hope around what is possible for us to do, and also let you know that the more things change, the more they stay the same, which is good for us, which means we have a playbook that we can be inspired by.
Can you tell us just a little bit as we're like wrapping up here? I would like to know, are there good things that you have found? Like when you say don't let them make you forget 2020, were there shifts in your life where you accommodated the reality of this plague that are still with you, that are good? Like
Oh,
you talked about
absolutely.
the good stuff, and I was like, yeah, those were good times, those early days of the pandemic in that way, not all the
The
people who
death
were
and all that
suffering.
stuff.
Yeah, not all the death, but the social shifts and the rhythm of life that was so suddenly changed for many of us, that was actually pretty good. I mean, again, if you were very isolated, it's still very traumatic, and we need supports for that as well. But did you make any shifts in your life that you are continuing with that you actually like?
Oh, yeah, man. You know, my son was not doing well in public school. And it was just like a perfect storm of probably a month or so before the lockdown. He refused to go back to school and he hasn't been back since. And he is thriving. I mean, he is absolutely thriving. We do some unschooling around here where he is in control. And the impact that this has had on my relationship with my child and really trusting that I don't have to abandon myself or my child in order for him to grow up safe, healthy, whole, and thrive, right? I don't have to throw him to the wolves of this school system. Anybody who's parenting or knows Gen Alpha kids, they are not with the shits. Why do I have to ask for permission to go to the bathroom? Why is the teacher always yelling? Why is lunch so short? Why don't we go outside? What is with all this homework? I mean, and like they're just not with the compliance of that especially us millennials in Gen X, you know, that we kind of were conditioned to deal with. So there's that. I think that another big shift for me is just divesting from capitalism as much as was within my power, right? I mean, I have become so acutely attuned to how capitalism manipulates time. It took me, what is, we're going into year five. It took me like 3 years to stop squeezing myself into these time constructs that were hurting my body. And so my pace of life is so much slower, especially when I'm not spending money in bars and restaurants and getting on planes and all of that stuff, which is like real dangerous right now, right? I've got books now. Like I can spend my money on books and I have time to read them. I think those are the big things. That slowing down the pace of my life, like I don't have to look forward to weekends. And I just want to say this is coming from a place of immense blessing in that I work for myself. And I manage my own time. And I have a place I live where I don't share hallways with people, right? I can go sit on my front porch, you know. I moved July 2020, and it was really the pandemic that gave me the courage to move 900 miles away from my immediate family. And so I'm still here. I'm slowing down. I'm moving slow. My relationship with my child has improved. Both of our health have improved, and this is with a lot of sacrifice. We don't see people. There's a way to see people safely, but we just don't. You know, we just don't, you know, and it's working for us for now. But everybody needs to put on a mask and clean the air so that we can leave my house, all right?
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, we haven't eaten in restaurants, though. We have, we get takeout. We have picnics. We like sit in the car, and that's still our pandemic date is still our date where we sit in the car and look at the ocean and eat Big Wheel Burger,
I
Like
love it.
it's still the best. When people want to come and visit, they know it's going to have to be like a nice day because we don't have a covered area, and if they're going to come inside, then there's a filter air cleaner right in front of them, and they're beside an open window, and they're masked, and they're about 12 feet away from us, and we're on the other side, and we've got a filter in front of us, and that's just how it's going to be if you want to hang. Otherwise, we're hanging outside, and if I don't, have a sense of, if I don't know that person, I'm putting on my mask even if we're
Absolutely.
outside. Like if you're not in my pod of, like, I think you're pretty COVID cautious, and we've taken tests before we hang out. Like, we have protocol. We have protocol, and people also know that that's the question. If you're inviting my kid to an art date, let's have a quiet art date where we're going to draw. I would love it if people would just volunteer. Here's what our COVID protocols are in our house, but I also have no problem asking. Tell me, what is the COVID protocol at your home? And, so far, so good. People are, oh, yes, we've got some filter. Great. Could you bring them right beside my child? Could you have them sitting by the window? Could you all be wearing masks? Could you, and so far, it's been pretty good, But yeah, that's a world we have to co-create. So, okay, the last question, always the same. How do you cope with the flip side of all this, the grief and the rage?
The People's Oracle, Divination for Liberation, the People's Public Health Education Campaign. I am a person with extraordinary self-discipline that makes me unique, right? I don't have issues changing my behavior and adapting, right? 2020 happened. I was like, oh, this is what we're doing now. Cool, right? It took some time to emotionally adapt, and particularly relationships with people who are still back in 2019 have been really difficult to maintain. And there's been a lot of grief and rage and sadness around that that I deal with regularly. But the COVID conscious community online keeps me sane. My social media is curated to be filled with people who are participating in the same reality as me. And channeling my rage and my grief into educating the public through the post that I make on my own social media and hearing people say, hey, you literally have saved my life. Like, man, whatever it is that's back in 2019 that people can't seem to let go of, like, this is so much sweeter, you know? And it's given me. I think a lot of people who are still COVID safe can relate to this, that this is like an automatic test in that I know if I can trust you for real based on how you're living right now, right? I know if you are a leader or a follower based on how you're living right now. I know whether or not I can trust your judgment based on how you're living right now. And unfortunately, it's a small group of us, you know, which I don't think it's that small because I don't think it's as small as they want us to think it is. But, you know, we are very well aware that how you've responded to COVID is such a deep statement about where your identity is. Where your values are, where your politics are. And just, it's such a deep statement about your relationship with yourself. And I understand that it's much harder for some people than others. Those who work retail, those who work in restaurants, those who have to take public transit, it is incredibly alienating. And I recognize that how hard that is. And so, solidarity. With those of you who are on the train and on the bus and in the restaurants and the grocery store serving people who don't give a care about your life. I care. And this public health education campaign is for you.
Let's get it together, right? Let's do it. Let's do it. I love this orientation towards the sweeter world and this what you say about trusting people. I mean, yeah, this is a test for how we're going to do with collapse, right? This is a test for how we're going to do with
This
the
is collapse.
environment. This
Shoot.
is collapse, right? Yeah, this is one of the steps on it. And so how is your community going to respond to wildfire or flood? You know what? We have a clue. How's your community going to respond to schools not having enough teachers? This is a clue. What do we have to do to get it together so we can live in this sweeter world that's based on reciprocity and mutual aid and taking care of each other? And so it's really good to hear you care. It's good to see your care in action. And the Numinous Podcast will be a proud supporter of the People's Public Health Education Campaign. Thank you so much for sharing this all with us, Dana. I'll see you at the meeting.
Thank you so much. Hope to see you guys there.
Links to The meeting for the People's Public Health Education Campaign, as well as many other resources mentioned in this episode, can be found in your podcast player or at numinouspodcast.com. I look forward to seeing you all at that meeting on April 3rd. I am not personally like super adept at science or epidemiology research or science communication or art. Like I'm reasonable, but I'm no expert. But I have enthusiasm for this movement. And I feel like I need to be around people who hold the same vision of collective care and community wellness that I do, and a future that is adaptable and responsive in case we ever have a novel pandemic again. Maybe we won't in our lifetimes, but you know, the odds are not in our favor. So I'm going to go to the meeting and learn all I can so I can amplify all I can and uplift the good work of the People's Public Health Education Campaign, however they need. I'm going to absorb those good vibes. I'm going to remember how it was and how it could be. And even though it isn't right now happening on the scale that I would like, I'm keen to ensure that like this type of grassroots movement succeeds in my little corner of the grass, you know? I'm just going to keep trying. And if it doesn't work at one scale, I'll just keep scaling it down until I find the scale that is receptive to this kind of collective care effort. Because, you know, man, the small and delicious life, man, it's a COVID cautious one. If you're interested in my 1-hour class on long COVID in the context of collapse, it's available with membership in the Numinous Network. So it's one of the lessons inside our Collapse 101 course, which is about a 20-hour on-demand video course at this point. Keep adding to it all the time. We have live witnessing circles. We have live AMAs as well. But I especially think what many people will appreciate inside the network around the topic of this episode is our twice monthly long COVID connection calls. So they're not just for long COVID sufferers. It's for anyone with a sensitive nervous system. If you experience autoimmunity, dysautonomia, or any other chronic or episodic disability, not just COVID comorbidities, you are very, very much welcome at this call. It's camera on or off. You can be self-diagnosed. It's very much centered around disability justice, but mostly it's just empathy, understanding, connection. You know, you will feel normal. You will feel validated. You will feel affirmed. You will be affirmed. And of course, we've got lots of other things in the Numinous Network to support you physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. And sort of adjacent to this topic, I just want to plant a seed here. I've got a course coming later this spring on moral injury. When I say a course, I think it'll be quite short because, you know, if you are a caregiver suffering moral injury, you're probably really freaking burnt out. So it's not a long course that I have planned, but it's a course for caregivers. It's one I've had in my head for a couple years now. Originally it was around supporting healthcare workers and mental health care workers and caregivers impacted because they were working on front lines during the early stage of the pandemic. So caregivers suffering from secondary trauma, sometimes called vicarious trauma, essentially a trauma exposure response. Commonly, this has been treated in like Western mental health with cognitive behavioral approaches and sometimes with a bit of like mindfulness sprinkled in. But I've been exploring the newer research derived from healthcare workers in the US and in China in the wake of the pandemic and looking at some of the newer thought on how we might adapt our approach to these times. So I should have come out with this earlier, sort of dragged my feet. I was focusing more on like the implementation of my theoretical framework, like the doing of that, the experimentation with that, with the creation of the Numinous Network, which is going to be 3 years old in April. But now that we're like 5 months into a genocide in Gaza and we're learning more and more about other genocides every day, the cognitive dissonance in society has reached a level of like derangement that I can't be quiet. I need to do more. I need to do more with my thoughts. And so it's time. So it feels like now is the moment. So the moral injury course, a course for caregivers, is coming this spring. So that's why I think you should sign up for my newsletter. If this stuff sounds interesting to you, like I haven't posted any information about this on my website. I probably won't. It's just for the special people. It's just for the people actually listening. So you can find out more about the Numinous Network and you can sign up for my, you know, intermittent newsletter that I have there at carmenspagnola.com, carmenspagnola. Until next time, take care.